Hey everyone, you're listening to Operation Dichotomy. I'm Paul, I'm your host, and we are the bridge between perception and reality. Remember, our goal here is to create a society of greater understanding and empathy. We want people to be able to slow down before they say anything and become more eager to listen and hear the other perspective, especially if it's different from theirs. And we believe that even just that small shift in our actions is going to solve a lot of the problems that we see around us today in our society. So if you are in line with that mission, and if it sounds like something that you want to be a part of, please go ahead and connect with us at operationdichotomy.com and give us a follow at Operation Dichotomy on Instagram, because that's where most of our stuff happens. You'll be sure to keep up to date if you follow us there. And last but not least, if you have found any value in these podcasts or the content that we put out, please go ahead and share. More people working together to share good stuff, to take action, it's going to change the world faster. So please go ahead and share that. Now that's out of the way, I wanted to introduce you to our guest today. His name is Jonasson Goldson, and he's one of the most interesting people that I've met. He is a rabbi. He is a well-known keynote speaker. He's been on the TEDx stage. He is the author of multiple books on ethical affluence. And if you're not sure what ethical affluence means, well, we'll probably talk about that a little bit today, so you'll get an idea of what that means and why it's important for you. Whether or not you even care about ethics, or whether or not you believe doing the right thing really matters, is going to affect you one way or another. And I like to kind of see him as your overall ethics expert, which is why I'm so excited to have him on the show today, because understanding these things at the end of the day is going to be what helps us. It's going to be what helps us to fulfill the mission that we want to fulfill in changing our society. So without further ado, Jonasson, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Paul. I was really very excited to discover you. I love your mission and I love your mission statement. And I think you've really got your finger on the pulse of what needs to be the approach that we take if we're going to make our society a healthier place. So my hat's off to you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that, especially coming from you. We're going to tell you, the audience, where to connect with him later. But like I said, he's the ethics expert here. We have him here because you better hear from him than from me, because I don't even know. So, Jonasson, this is where I want to start, just because it's one of the interesting things that I've seen on your website. You call yourself the man with 3,000 years of experience. What does that mean?
Well, to give you a real quick thumbnail, I studied English at the University of California, and I put my English degree to good use by going hitchhiking cross country and backpacking across Europe. And after a year, I ended up in Israel, and I reconnected with my Jewish tradition, my Jewish roots. That's where I lived for 9 years. I became a rabbi, met my wife, had our first 2 children. And then I set off on a career teaching high school Jewish students, which I did for 23 years. And what I discovered in my studies and through my teaching is that the ancient tradition that's handed down from Sinai and really forms the foundation of all of Western civilization and contemporary values, it can all be boiled down to a single word, which is ethics. Ethics is the awareness of how our actions affect those around us. It's recognizing and committing ourselves to disciplining ourselves, to do what we ought to do, to make the right choices, to see something beyond ourselves. And all of Jewish tradition is focused on that ideal. How do I become the best version of myself in a way that contributes to the world in the most positive way possible? And all of that accumulated wisdom is there for us to take if we can simply access it, if we can distill it, and if we can translate it into a language that's a little bit easier for us to understand in the modern world. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even require us necessarily to have a religious perspective. It's really something that transcends that. It goes to the core of our humanity and the essence of what it means to live as part of a civil society.
You said something very interesting that is said pretty often these days about becoming your best self, best version of yourself. And, you know, people always talk about your best life now, becoming the best version of myself, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like in this modern society, the reason why it's so popular to do that and to be that way is because we want to be our best selves for our best selves, because we don't want to miss out on anything. It's that YOLO culture, right? You only live once. I'm gonna have fun and do my own thing in the best way possible. What's interesting from the Sinai or Jewish tradition for the last 3,000 years, it's really about becoming your best self for the sake of others and for the sake of serving your community as a whole. And I wonder if we've lost that, where becoming our best self is not about us, but it's about the greater good. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right that we've shifted the focus way too much onto ourselves, but the root of the problem is that it's a false dichotomy. In other words, what I do to make myself better makes the world better. And what I do to make the world better gives me a better world to live in, which means I can make myself better. The old cliche is a high tide raises all ships. And so the more we contribute, and if you're, I mean, think about it. I like to use sports analogies. What makes a good team? You know, again, famous cliche, there's no I in team, but what does that mean? It means that each person has a specific job, a specific position. And if I'm playing my position the way I'm supposed to be, then I'm contributing to the team. I'm making the team better. And because I'm playing as part of a better team, I'm playing better. If you have 11 quarterbacks on a football team, you're going to lose. Even if they're all Tom Brady, it's not going to make a difference. You're not going to have that harmony. I mean, take another analogy, a symphony. Do you want a symphony with all violins or all brass players or all woodwinds? Doesn't matter what your favorite instrument is. It's only through those differences and that harmonization that we end up with a symphony. And when you have a symphony, it means everybody's playing at his best level or her best level as part of a greater whole. And so to say, well, I'm going to be my best version for me, or I'm going to be my best version for others, we don't have to make that choice. And it's thinking that we have to make that choice that actually sends us off in the wrong directions.
Interesting. Now, do you focus on, because there's two sides to that, right? It's almost like it's a win-win situation. If you become better, your whole team becomes better. And then, like you said, the team becomes better, you become better again. Is there one or the other that you focus on? Because I can see people being like, I want to focus on building myself to, building up my sense of ethics. I don't know if that's the correct way to say it. For the sake of building up a team. And by focusing on myself, the high tide raises other ships as well. Or are you supposed to focus more on the communal aspect? What came first, chicken or the egg?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to phrase the question. The truth is that it really does start with the individual. There's an expression in Jewish tradition called tikkun olam. I talk about this in my keynote speeches. It means repair the world. But ultimately, the only world I can repair is me. Sure, I can go off and try to save the rainforest and save the whales and volunteer for Habitat for Humanity. That's all wonderful. But the only thing I really have control over is myself. My reactions, my responses, my discipline, my sense of direction and purpose, my ethic, as opposed to my ethics. It's all part of the same thing. And the more I develop myself, the greater the contribution I can make to the world. Now, at the same time, what drives me has to be an awareness that I am contributing to the world. If I'm trying to develop myself at the expense of others, then I'm also entering into a kind of self-deception. Because when I act in a way that takes advantage of other people or suppresses other people or hurts other people, And I validate that because I got to look out for number one. I'm really doing myself harm as well because I'm turning myself into a less principled, less ethical person. And I'm not becoming my best self, even if I may be winning in that sort of me versus you type of format.
That's so counterintuitive, I feel like, to today's culture, where when you said we're not building ourselves up at the expense of other people. Instead, we want to build ourselves up for the sake of other people. It's almost like, again, I guess it goes back to the idea of having a false dichotomy where, I don't know if I'm correct on saying this, but I feel like the general public's perception is that successful people, whether it's in ethics or business or whatever they do, the way they get to that level of success is by either taking advantage of other people or it's at the expense of other people. Where in reality, for the most part, it sounds like the more you serve and the more your focus is not just on bettering yourself for yourself, but bettering yourself for the sake of the team or the community, that's how you get to the position of where you want to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a, excuse me, a naturally intuitive perspective to say that I have to choose between being good and being successful. I have to choose between looking out for me and looking out for others. And that's the fallacy. It simply isn't true. There are all kinds of surveys now, more and more all the time, that show that companies that are ranked highest for ethics are growing faster. They have employees who are more engaged, more loyal, more passionate, more productive. Mm-hmm. It really is the ultimate win-win. And when if you look at some of the great disasters, personal and business, I mean, Enron, you know, it's already a while ago. Seems like it was fairly recent, but I mean, Enron was characterized by they encouraged a cutthroat type of work environment, and they tried to pit their employees against one another. Well, that didn't turn out real well. Look at someone like Lance Armstrong, who appeared to be the great American hero, when in fact he was gaming the system. Yeah. He destroyed people, and ultimately he destroyed himself. Whereas if you look at businesses that are hugely successful, there's some really wonderful business models. I mean, Trader Joe's. You walk into Trader Joe's, everybody looks happy because they treat their employees so well. People love working there, even though they may not be doing the most stimulating work in the world. But there's an environment that's created that brings out the best in everybody. Yeah. If the story is about Zappos shoes, have fostered this incredibly positive work culture. People just love being part of it. And so what happens? Everybody's engaged. Everybody's working harder. And the brand image prospers. They acquire a reputation. People want to shop with a company that they feel good about. We all want to have a sense of purpose, even if that purpose is just, I'm buying my products from a place that I believe is a place of quality, a place of ethics, and a place of vision.
Yeah. I would throw a Chick-fil-A in there as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
When you go in there, everybody's smiling. Everybody's always happy. You come out feeling good, not just because of chicken sandwich, but because of the culture that you're surrounded by, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Let's move into ethical affluence, because I feel like we're kind of talking about that. But what exactly is ethical affluence? How do you define it? Let's start there.
Well, we're sort of already at that point. Ethical affluence is simply an awareness that success is the inevitable outcome of doing the right thing. And that when we commit ourselves to doing what's right, we prosper. And we create a culture of prosperity. All the things we just talked about, in terms of business, in terms of sports, when people feel that they're part of something greater than themselves, then that produces a positive energy. It's really the source of happiness. Mm-hmm. It's actually the first step of all the 12-step rehabilitation programs, right? Acknowledge that there's something greater than yourself. Because if it's all about me, then everything rises and falls on my success. I can have a fantastic year, a fantastic week, a fantastic month. And then one little thing comes along and trips me up and it's all over. It's all about, everything is just tainted by, and often something very trivial. You know, I stubbed my toe in the morning. My computer didn't start up properly. Things that in the grand scheme of things are pretty insignificant. But if I'm connected to something greater than myself, then that buoys me. That carries me. I'm the success of those around me is my success. And if I'm struggling, others are going to pull me up. And if those around me are struggling, I'm going to pull them up. And that's going to make me feel better about myself. Mm-hmm. It's an ethical mindset that drives us by reminding us by letting us remind ourselves mm-hmm. that we don't have to choose again between us and others. We don't have to choose between being good and being successful. It's all a package deal. But it really only works when it's a community. It's very difficult to hold yourself to a higher standard when those around you are not. Hmm. And that's why I think it was Joe Rogan who said, it's become very popular, you are the five people you spend most of your time with.
Yeah,
I believe if you it. Hang out with good people, you're going to become a good person. You hang out with people who aren't good, then they're going to pull you down.
So here's a question there, because this kind of taps into my own personal faith as well, where let's go back to the, you are the five people that you surround yourself with. Ideally, you want to surround yourself with five great people who are doing great things and doing the right thing all the time, because that's going to affect you positively. But then there's the other perspective of if you surround yourself, or if you're surrounded by five people and those are the ones that define who you are, essentially, that means that when you're one of the five of somebody else's associations, you're also affecting them positively or negatively. And so I feel like there's a little dichotomy there too, where yes, I want to be pulled up in a sense with those that are ethically affluent, but at the same time, is there an obligation for me, assuming that I am quote unquote ethically affluent, to hang around with somebody who is less so in order to affect them positively?
Certainly. That's sometimes we have to be teachers, sometimes we have to be students. First, we have to be students before we can be teachers. Mm. And in fact, the sages say that we learn a lot from our teachers, we learn more from our colleagues, and we learn most from our students. Huh. Because if I'm going to teach, first of all, I have to know my material cool. If I'm not clear, I'm just going to sow confusion. And beyond that, I have to model what I teach, because students, especially young people, say they see right through fakery. Mm-hmm. And if you don't walk the walk, they're not going to believe the talk. So I just saw a wonderful post on LinkedIn this morning. A boss posted that she had hired a fairly, a younger person, whatever they call the labels these days, generation, this, that, or the other. And the person had no experience, had no serious credentials, but the person was on time. In fact, they were early, well-dressed, honest about their lack of experience, and just conducted themselves with a professionalism and an enthusiasm that demonstrated, I want to learn to be a contributing member to this organization. I believe in what you believe in. I like your mission statement. I think I can make a contribution. And the boss believed in this sincerity and authenticity and commitment and took a chance. And I just love this story, because we get so caught up in labels, in brand names. There's so much talent waiting out there in the world to be discovered. And it gets overlooked, because people are too enamored. Well, this person has a name, that person has a name. And very often the people with the names may lose their edge because they get too comfortable. Because I've been doing this for a while. I don't have to push myself that hard. You know, it's the people that are always looking to keep that edge. And the people who are looking in unlikely places to find new truths, new insights, and new allies and new alliances. So yeah, we need to look up to attach ourselves to people greater than us. And we have to look down, so to speak, to help pull up those people so they can then pass it forward and help others.
How do you balance that? You touched upon it a little bit, where you have to know your stuff and be an example of what you want to teach before you can mentor, I say that lightly, that's the wrong word. Before you pull someone up, you have to be in a position to pull them up, right?
Right.
Another common thing that I hear these days is if you're not lifting me up, then you can just get out of my life. I'm going to cut you out, because I just heard this recently, cancel culture. I don't know if you've heard of cancel culture, but basically, you're more cool than I am, because I had no idea what that was. But it's like cancel culture these days. And for those of you who are like me and been living under a rock, cancel culture means that because someone disagrees with one thing or annoys you in one small thing that they do, you just cancel them from your life, essentially. Like Jonasson could be here and be like, hey, he's a rabbi. Oh, I don't like that. I don't care about who he is. Beyond that, he's out of my life. Forget about it. That's cancel culture. And I feel like it's very popular, right? That's why that cancel culture term exists. But I think given our conversation right now, we know that that's probably not the right way to go about it. But at the same time, if there's too much negativity around us, then that's going to be bringing us down and maybe making us more negative as well, because if we have 5 negative people around us, then, you know, we become the power of association, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you balance that?
Yeah, you just said so much right there. We could go off in so many different directions.
Sorry, it's
No, it's. I mean, this really gets to the heart of what it's all about. And this cancel culture, it's a cancer. Maybe we should call it cancer culture. Where do I start? If one of the biggest blights on an enlightened society is groupthink. And that's where cancel culture comes from. Groupthink means I only associate with people who think exactly like me. I only listen to opinions and take in information and accept information if it fits in with my view that I've already established. I mean, when I listen to the news, which isn't that often because it's I just don't trust the outlets anymore.
Yeah.
But you know, I'll look at the headlines at Google News, and then I'll look at the headlines in Fox News, because I know I'm going to get very, very different perspectives. I'll watch a little bit of Fox. I'll listen to NPR. And my conservative friends say, how can you listen to NPR? And my liberal friends say, how can you listen to Fox News? Well, if I'm listening to the different sides, then there at least is a chance I might be able to form an opinion about where the truth might actually lie. Hmm. But if I'm only listening to one side of the story, I can't possibly know the whole picture. I can't possibly understand the truth. And I can't possibly be ethical, because I'm simply not seeing enough of the story to make a sound judgment. And this idea of canceling out anybody that disagrees with me, I mean, what happens when a group of us sit around and we parrot the same ideas and we nod and we agree and nobody dares to say anything against the party line, because if I do, I'm going to be excommunicated and thrown out of the group. I mean, again, I talk about this in my keynotes, that you can point to all kinds of disasters in history that were brought about through groupthink, because dissenting opinions were not allowed. I think one of the most important voices today is Jonathan Haidt, who's written some really, really wonderful books, and he's got TED Talks, he's got articles. He's just such a relevant thinker, and he says that if you don't have conservatism, then you don't have a respect for tradition and for convention and for established values and experience. And if you don't have liberalism, you don't have forward looking, you don't have the sense of wanting to improve, you don't have the sense of innovation. But each philosophy needs the other, because each one can spiral towards the extremes. Conservatism can become calcified, and liberalism can turn into irrational utopianism. And you need that back and forth between the two and that engagement if you're going to have both movements remaining healthy and remaining cooperative and collaborative, as opposed to the partisanship and the cancel culture that you find today.
What is your perspective on the state of our country today? Because we're kind of talking about the cancer culture and how that leads two separate sides to become more separate and disunified. And obviously our country is called the United States of America for a reason, because that's what we're trying to be. But I remember in our conversation last time, you mentioned a little bit about your opinion on what our society looks like and what the state is, and maybe even what direction we could go.
Yeah, so my vision and my hope is that the polarization and the partisanship and the lack of civility will have a recoil effect. Just for the record, full disclosure, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I happened to watch, I did something I don't normally do, and I watched most of the Democratic debate last night. And it was just embarrassing. I felt so sad for the country, not because of necessarily the particular positions that anyone's taking, but the whole structure of the questions that were being asked by the moderators. It was a whole night of gotcha. Oh, you said this once. Oh, you did this once. Oh, you supported this person who did something once. What do you want? You want everybody is supposed to be perfect and get everything right all the time. And that means agree with me all the time and never say anything wrong and never forget anything and never have the opportunity to change an opinion or to say, sorry, I made a mistake. I mean, it's so irrational. And what's the purpose of having a debate where the whole point is trying to trip people up and catch people up? Is it all about ratings? Is it all about trying to find the worst in people so that we're left with a slate of candidates that nobody likes and nobody can support? I was incredibly frustrated. And I think that, and again, full disclosure, I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I didn't see that there was an option there that was viable. And so I voted third party, even though I didn't like that either. But I think that, and it's not just my observation, I think that Donald Trump is a reaction to what many in this country see as political correctness gone out of control. The disintegration of values. And the irony is that he's not a person who represents values at all. It's just there was a disgust with feelings towards one side, and so there was an overreaction to the other side. And my hope is that there will then be a re-reaction that will bring more of us into the center. By center, I don't mean some arbitrary point where we just stick a flag in the middle and say this is something that's balanced, but no. A center in the terms of moderation, where we can talk about our different positions, where, as you've said in your introduction, we can disagree passionately, but we could still respect each other because we can understand where we're coming from, and we can understand that we ultimately want to get to a place that's better for all of us. And you know, I hope that is something that is still achievable, and perhaps we'll come out of all of this acrimony as people decide we just have to find a third way.
Can you share some practical tips for the listeners? We mentioned ethical affluence and we talk about the state of our country. And sometimes I feel like people feel a little bit helpless. Like we're just kind of along for the ride of this political nightmare of what's going on in our country. We don't know what to do. I know in your TED Talk, you wrap things up in the talk with different steps to think about and how to move forward so that we could actually make a difference in our communities. If you could share those things, I feel like there'd be so much benefit to anybody who's listening right now.
Yeah, sure. You're asking me to remember what I said, which is always a bit of a challenge. but I go through a series of steps where we start out that we have to be able to establish credibility. And that means that I have to be able to articulate my point of view so that you can understand where I'm coming from, even if you haven't already bought into it. There's so much preaching to the choir. It goes back to the news stations. We're talking to people that already think like us. So we don't necessarily have to think through our points of view. We don't have to really defend our logic. There may not even be any logic there. It can be a lot of dogma and a lot of rhetoric and a lot of slogans. But if I want you to take me seriously when we're not already in agreement, I have to have thought through my position and be able to explain and articulate it in a way that you can understand it and it can seem rational to you. Then I have to play the other side. I have to let you explain your position to me. I have to listen. I have to understand. And that will establish trust, because that demonstrates to you that I respect you, that I take you seriously, and that I'm willing to listen to what you have to say and try to understand where you're coming from. Right? Then we have to have integrity. And that means that we have to be consistent. We have to live up to our own values, and we have to apply them evenly. I mean, it makes my blood boil when again and again and again you hear people on one side of the aisle condemning the behavior and then defending it when people on their side do exactly the same thing. Yeah. I mean, there's no consistency. There's unapologetic, unashamed double standards. It's just infuriating. And it destroys the fabric of society. It just unravels everything that we're supposed to believe in. And then we have to have humility. And this is a point where, it's so really obvious, I think, but it just gets overlooked that once we have invested ourselves in a point of view, it's very difficult for us to then see other points of view or to reevaluate the point of view that we've already invested in. And so we have to continuously re-examine our beliefs and make sure that we've come to them in a way of intellectual integrity. Because sometimes we'll discover that we may have absorbed our values from our environment, from our parents, from our peers, from our teachers. And sometimes we may find that things that may have been true in one time and one circumstance may be more complicated, may be more nuanced, maybe circumstances have changed, and ideas that applied once may no longer apply or may have to be updated or modified to fit into new circumstances. And if we go through this process on a regular basis, you know, there used to be an expression, all politics is local. And it seems as if now it's the opposite. All politics is national. As everybody's looking to the president, everybody's looking to these national issues. And they're so big, that's what makes us feel helpless, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we could start in our own families, if we could start in our neighborhoods, our own communities, our churches, our synagogues, our community centers, block parties, know your neighbors. Mm-hmm. If we can rebuild our communities, then I think that will start to trickle or seep outwards. Seepage, I think, is more the analogy of the trickling. Mm-hmm. But it'll seep out. and it'll start. And then this is why I focus my discussions very often on business, because one thing we all agree on, we want to make more money. Mm-hmm. So if we create a more civil, healthier, successful business environment, then we'll start to bring that home with us instead of coming home bitter and angry and frustrated because I hate my job and then take it out on my family and have no interest in my neighbors. Instead, I'll be energized by work. I'll come home in a better mood. I'll have a better family environment. I'll be more likely to reach out to my neighbors. Any vicious circle can be turned around and made into a virtuous circle. And that starts on a very local level.
Hmm. Oh, I love it. I think everything that you just said, number one, I agree with. But two, it was just so clearly articulated, even though the concepts generally are pretty simple. And it almost seems so common sense that we shouldn't even have to talk about it. But looking at our society, clearly it's not common sense. I'm going to just recap it real quick in an outline. Number one, just to make sure I understood it too, is you have to understand why you believe what you believe. And you have to be able to think through it and express it in a way that somebody else will understand. Not a heated, argumentative way where you're beating it down somebody's throat. It's, this is what I believe, this is why. Flip side, number two, is you have to be able to understand and listen to the other perspective with an attitude of humility, which is number four. So we'll skip ahead to number four, humility. To me, that means understanding and being aware that you might be wrong, quote unquote wrong. Your perspective might have been skewed by different things that you've gone through in life. And humility just means that you're humble enough to accept the fact that you may not know everything. And if we go backwards to number three, integrity is just being consistent with what you believe. And it just means living, practicing what you preach, right? If your ethics are a certain way, your life should portray that. And I love that last part that you said, because that's one of the things that we believe in so strongly at Operation Dichotomy, is when we look at this huge problem we see in our country, or what we believe to be a huge problem, beginning at the national level all the way to our local communities, I guess, it almost seems overwhelming for us to be able to even start addressing that issue. But like you said, it starts in our communities. It starts with me and it starts with you. And if we as individual people are building up our own ethical affluence and becoming better people who are more likely to go out of the way to do the right thing, not only will the seepage happen where you're affecting those around you, but they're also going to do the same thing. And aren't we the building blocks of this country? And aren't the small societies and communities within the greater country really the building blocks of the United States as a whole? If we change our small communities, by virtue, the greater community is going to change as well. So I love it. And I'm so glad you put it that way.
You summed it up very nicely. And the last point you made, I have a new book coming out this year. Mm-hmm. It presents a number of ethical scenarios to try and see both sides of any issue before reaching a resolution. Now, one of the questions I raise in there is a famous question. Why should we vote? Yeah. If you think about it, never in history, at least not the history of this country, has there ever been an election of more than 25,000 people where it was decided by one vote? Which means that my vote on a statewide level, certainly a national level, and even on most local levels, is not going to make a difference. So why should I vote? And so one of my rabbis gives the following analogy. He says, imagine that there's a town at the bottom of a ravine, and they get word that there's been a dam break up the hill, and the floodwaters are descending on their town, and are going to destroy everything. But if everybody gets up first thing in the morning and carries a stone or a brick up to the entry to the outlet of the ravine, we could build a dam that will stop the water and save the city. But it's only going to work if every member of the town, all 1,000 residents of the town, are going to take their brick and carry it up to this place. And so I wake up that morning and I look out my window and it's cold and it's dreary. and I really don't feel like going out. So the wheels start turning in my head. Right? Well, let's see. What if everybody goes except me? Okay, 999 is as good as 1,000. So we'll be fine. What if nobody goes? Well, then what good is my one brick going to do? It's not going to make a difference. What if some people go and some people don't go? So maybe you get 400, 600, 873. Maybe it'll be enough. Maybe it won't. But still, my one brick is not going to make the difference. So I have a very sound, logical reason for staying in bed. Why should I get up? Well, first, because it's my town. Because as you said earlier, so correctly, a community, a society is made up of individuals. And because I'm invested in this town and this community, therefore I feel a sense of duty to do my part and contribute what I can. Because it's only through individual efforts together that any community survives. But the second part is, if I look out my window and I see that lots of people are going, I'm going to feel much more obligated to get up and go myself. I don't feel right staying in bed when everyone else is going out to save the town. Whereas if I look out and I don't see anybody, I'm going to be much more likely to just stay in bed and say, well, what difference does it make? So the way we act privately isn't entirely private, because our actions are witnessed by those around us and may actually have an effect to motivate others to do what they're supposed to do. And with this mindset, this is how communities survive and thrive.
Oh, man. We started by saying you were the guy with 3,000 years of experience, and now I believe it. It's... I love everything that you're saying. This is probably one of my most favorite conversations that I've had so far on this topic. Maybe because you're the ethical affluence expert, you just have a lot of good stuff to say. But we're out of time. But thank you so much for being here with us. I want to make sure people know where to find you, Jonasson, because I know there's a wealth of information that you haven't shared today, just because you know so much. Where would be a good place for our audience to find you and connect with you?
Well, certainly the best place to find me is at my website, which is my name, jonassongoldson.com. Might be a little hard to spell sometimes, jonassongoldson.com. Very active on LinkedIn, a little less so on the other social media, but you can find me there too if you like. And always eager for listeners to reach out. Always looking for ways to keep the conversation going.
Perfect. I'll go ahead and put the website on the show notes so that people can find it and make it easy for them, because, you know, they're looking for the easy way out. So I'll oblige them in that sense. JonassonGoldson.com. Before we close, because we kind of painted you in this ethical, affluent picture, we don't want that to be the only thing that the audience knows about you. So, good sir, what is one weird thing about you that most people don't know?
I recently implemented in my daily routine what I call juggling therapy. I spend way too much time sitting at my desk in front of my computer. And I heard there's a fellow named Jim Quick, that fascinating fellow. Mm-hmm. It's worth looking up online. He talks about ways that we can keep our brains healthy. And certainly using them intellectually is one way. But we also have to be physically active. And he says one of the best things that we can do for our brains is to juggle.
Really?
Because it requires all the different parts of body and mind. You know, if you don't know how to juggle, there are other things. I think sports like tennis, where you have to move and you have to anticipate where the ball's going to go, and you have to gauge the strength and the you've got your gross muscle, you've got your fine muscle movement. But I needed something that I could do for just a few minutes a couple of times a day in my home office. And so I started juggling, and I find that it really gives me a needed break from the, it's not healthy to stay too focused, too intent for too long, certainly not in the sitting position. So it allows me to get everything flowing, get the muscles, get the brain working, get the coordination working, and hope it's keeping me healthier and sharper.
Wow. That is interesting. Do you juggle balls?
Actually, I the problem with balls, I mean, I'm not a great juggler. The balls you have to go chase. bean bags are good, but I didn't have any of those. So I went down in the cellar and I found my kids' old Beanie Babies.
Oh.
So I juggle Beanie Babies, which actually makes it a little harder because they're all shaped a little differently. So it requires a little more dexterity.
How many do you juggle at a time?
I just do three.
Okay. It'll work up to 10.
Maybe someday.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jonasson. It's been a true pleasure having you on the show. I'll be honest, because of our conversations before, I didn't think I would learn even more, but I did. So thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for sharing your 3,000 years of experience. And I trust that the audience has learned a lot and hopefully they can take something to apply to their lives as well, because it's really, again, together in our small communities, wherever everybody is, we are the ones making that small difference that's going to make the greater difference in our society. So keep pushing, keep moving forward. That's all we have for you today, guys. Until next time.